After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It was a tough day for so many when we found out that the legendary Bill Walton passed away at the age of 71. It was also so cool to see the outpouring of love and the stories people had involving Bill Walton throughout the years. We're not just talking about inside the basketball world, outside the basketball world. The lives he touched in such a positive way with the joy he brought to life. Because he went through a lot. Not only as an NBA player, but all the surgeries he had, the stuttering issue he overcame, and he turned into one of the most important people in basketball. But his life was so much bigger than basketball, too. I grew up hating Bill Walton in the early 2000s. I'll never forget the 2002 Kings-Lakers series. And it just felt like, is he rooting for the Lakers? I was 13 years old. I didn't like him at all. And when he got hired by the Kings, like 2010, you're like, Bill Walton, what? But as I grew older, I just gained such an appreciation for this guy. And I feel so lucky that I had a chance to talk to him for close to an hour about the 2002 Kings-Lakers series. No one has heard this conversation publicly besides myself, but I felt like it was appropriate to share because what it highlights is Bill Walton's joy for the game. His memories that flooded back talking about that series, the passion he had talking about those teams, and I felt like I got to share it with the people. This conversation took place during the pandemic, early pandemic, April 2020, and I had reached out to him because I was working on the project that we haven't finished yet with my guy Jason Ross, and we were doing kind of an audio documentary looking back at the 2002 Kings playoff run. And I feel like I got to reach out to Bill Walton about this. And so I reached out to Bill thinking, oh, maybe I'll be able to catch up with him for a few minutes. And let me be clear. I reached out to him, but Bill Walton didn't know me. He treated me like he knew me. And I felt like he made so many people he interacted with feel important. I maybe asked him five questions in this entire conversation. And I just sat back and soaked up classic Bill Walton, who would turn a simple question into a 10-minute answer and weave in stories and quotes. You just sit back and you enjoy it. I feel so honored that I got that opportunity. So I wanted to share that with you. Bill Walton's memories of the 2002 Kings-Lakers series that he called so many of those games. And he had so many stories from that time. So enjoy it and rest in peace, Bill Walton.
There was a lot of animosity between the two teams. And they had played in the playoffs previous years. And of course, that 2002 one was a significant moment. Could you feel that animosity from your vantage point when you were broadcasting those games?
I love competitive sports. And one of the reasons I love them the most is how fierce and intense and the level of animosity between the two teams when the fate of the known world is on the line, in the balance, and the players, they show me that this matters to them. They show me that that they care. And so when the Kings and the Lakers were going at it there in the early 2003 straight years, I mean, this was a franchise that had trouble. Only one NBA franchise title back in 1951. The champs beating the Knicks in seven games after the Rochester Royals, though, they had Arnie Risen, Red Holtzman, Bob Davies, Bobby Wanzer, all friends of mine over the course of my life. Now, the long and winding, arduous road, the Kings end up in Sacramento, and they have to take on the mighty Lakers. The Lakers, not the most successful franchise, but the most popular franchise, the media capital, entertainment capital of so much of the world. And here they were. And what the Kings were able to do was absolutely spectacular. And I loved the trash talking, and I loved them going back and forth. I do not like participating in it myself. That was never my deal. I wanted to let my game do my talking for me. But as a broadcaster, as a fan, when they were going at it, it just tickled my heart, and it just fired me up. But I do not like it when it gets personal.
And it did get personal at times, right?
I don't like denigrating the opposition. One of my heroes growing up was Wilt Chamberlain. And Wilt Chamberlain was basically Santa Claus. And in this magnificent, huge, towering presence of a physical being unmatched in history. And Wilt never had a bad thing to say publicly about anyone. Every time a new player would come in the league, Wilt would talk him up. Every time he's going up against a big rival, Wilt would talk him up. And then the game would start, and Wilt would go out and get 70 points on him. And then just walk off the court and say, yeah, I'm Wilt Chamberlain, and nobody else is. That's the kind of approach and dignified response that I always loved and appreciated. But as the game, as our culture changed and evolved over the years, and it became so much more personal, and the fans were so much involved, and how the pride and the credibility and the integrity that goes with being a great NBA franchise and team and going up in the playoffs here, and with the Lakers having some real personalities, Phil Jackson, Kobe, Shaq, the main guys out there. And here were the Sacramento Kings, who were coming up and had not had great success since coming in 1985 to Arco in Sacramento, other than the incredible victory by the Sacramento Kings over the Boston Celtics in 1986. The Celtics won trip there, and it was a remarkable game that night for Sacramento, but not for the Boston Celtics, where I was on that team. Didn't play very much, but I was still on the team. And when you're a member of the team, when you win, there's something for everybody. When you lose, there's nothing for anyone. But the way these two teams were building toward this incredible climatic confrontation in 2002, because they had played three straight years in the final, I mean, in the playoffs. Yeah. In the first year, 2000, it was it was best of five in those days. It was home court the whole way through. And so 2-0 Lakers, 2-2 coming into game five, and then it was all Lakers in game five. And the next year, it was another convincing victory for the Lakers, who were on their way to one of the great playoff runs ever, statistically the greatest, only one loss. And I believe that loss was to Sacramento. It was a five-game. No, the Lakers swept Sacramento that year. But then, coming into 2002, because the Sacramento Kings had made the brilliant trade to get Mike Bibby. Yes, Jason Williams was a hugely popular, very successful, tremendous guy and a fabulous basketball player. But to get Mike Bibby, wow. And that leads us right in to what Jeff Petrie meant to this remarkable run of glory for the Sacramento Kings. Because in Jeff's 11 years, 9 playoffs, 2 times executive of the year, he was there for this phenomenal run of of brilliance, of excellence, of community involvement, and he did it in every way imaginable. He did it with the draft picks. Peja at 14. Turgaloo, he knew himself, yeah, number 16. Gerald Wallace, 25. Kevin Martin, way down the list as well. But he wasn't part of this 2002 team. Kevin Martin came later. And then the trades for Chris Webber, the trades for Mike Bibby, the trade for Doug Christie, and later on, the trade for Brad Miller. And so the free agents, Vladin, Bobby Jackson, Scott Pollard, later on, Jim Jackson, and his ability, Jeff Petrie, to see the vision of having a team come together, to have the knowledge to hire Rick Adelman. Rick Adelman was there for eight of those 11 years with Jeff Petrie. And Rick Adelman and Jeff Petrie went back to their early days together in Portland. And it's important to note that Rick Adelman, even though they had this incredibly fierce rivalry, Sacramento and the Lakers, Rick Adelman's from Los Angeles and he grew up a Laker fan, and Jerry West was his favorite player, and Jerry West put all these teams together. Now, Jerry had to leave when Phil Jackson got there for the Lakers, but Jerry West has always been a Laker and will always be a Laker. And to have Rick Adelman have, as every young boy in Southern California from that era, grew up just idolizing Jerry West and what a phenomenal, remarkable player, person he was. Ultimately, he became a better executive, a better front office executive than he was as a basketball player. And he's one of the greatest players ever to play the entire sport at every level, high school, college, pro, every, you know, international, everywhere. So it was just fantastic. And so with Jeff Petrie able to put it all together, he had to have the support of ownership. And the Malou family, fantastic. Starting with Colleen, the mom, and Joe and Gavin and George, Philip, Adrian, the whole family was involved. And what the Maloufs did, they made it fun. They came from the entertainment business. They came from social enterprises. They came from community. They came from family and the team. And they extended that to their Sacramento Kings. And they made it such a remarkable destination of joy and hope and happiness. And Arco Arena was the place to be. The culture that they built, the scene, out in front. I remember we'd be getting there, man. Those fans in that parking lot, that was like the Great Bethesda parking lot. They were just so fired up and ready to go. There'd be bands out there and balloons and people all dressed up. They brought the cowbells. And then once they came inside, oh my gosh, the intensity, the ferocity, the tenacity, it was absolutely spectacular. That stuff doesn't just happen. That comes from the created culture, the culture that comes from the leadership, from the Maloufs, Jeff Petrie. And then you can never discount the impact that Pete Carril had, because Pete was the college coach at Princeton for Jeff Petrie. Pete Carril, a Hall of Famer himself, just an initiator of a beautiful team basketball. And that's the game that Jeff Petrie played. That's what he learned. That's what he taught. That's what he built. And so with Pete Carril, they are on the sidelines at practice every day, because the separation that has to exist between what Jeff Petrie does, what the Maloufs do, and the executive side, that's different from what happens on the court. And you don't ever really want to cross that line, because ultimately the head coach, Rick Adelman, he has to have the ultimate say as to what goes on the court. And so you have this fabulous leadership team, the Maloufs, Jeff Petrie, Pete Carril. And the way that my career has evolved from being a basketball player, growing up in San Diego, to going to UCLA, to being a member of the NBA for the Blazers and the Clippers and the Celtics, and then going into the broadcasting, and to be able to do all those different things and have it always keep coming back to Sacramento, because the simple twist of fate has it that when I was coming back from my spine challenges and my near-death experience and life-changing experience with my spine now 12 years ago, back in 2008 and 9, my first job back in broadcasting was with the Sacramento Kings, and how fortunate I was to be working with Jim Gray, with Grant, with the G-Man, with the Maloofs, and all the different people. Jeff Petrie was still there. It was fantastic. And so it was a tremendous situation for me and an opportunity. And now, as it all rolls into one and comes full circle, our third son is the head coach of the Sacramento Kings. So who would have ever thought? But if you put it all together and understand that the Walton family's ties to the Central Valley, my wife, Lori, is from Tracy. My dad is from Taft. We are Central Valley roots there. And to know and love the state of California as I do, and to be there on a constant basis, to be there with the Grateful Dead, to be there as the broadcaster, to be in Cal Expo, to be at the Armory with the Jerry Garcia Band, to be at the state capitol with all the different governors, to be in Sacramento for the Amgen Tour of California bike race, to be right there in the center of this most remarkable and incredible, spectacular, empty the thesaurus to come in here and to see what is possible in the world. And now it is just coming back to the top of the mountain where it belongs. That franchise, appropriately named the Kings, at the top.
I love it. You fire me up, Bill. You called those games with Mike Breen and Steve Snapper Jones. I know it was a long time ago, but do you recall putting down the headset after some of those games going, I can't believe how good this series is?
I loved the way the Sacramento Kings played, and what a roster that they had, with Mike Bibby and Doug Christie in the backcourt, backed up by Bobby Jackson and Gerald Wallace. I mean, versatile, complementary, interchangeable, different contributions by each and every one of them. Mike Bibby, you know, a big time scorer. Doug Christie, an all around player who loved to do all the dirty work. Bobby Jackson, a lead player. Bobby Jackson can do it all by himself. And then Gerald Wallace, just this diamond in the rough who was just being polished and all the dirt washed away on a constant basis. And then that front line, Chris Webber, Vlade, Peja, Turkoglu, backed up by Scott Pollard and Lawrence Funderburk. Wow, what a team. What pieces. And, you know, with Chris Webber, you had a Hall of Fame level player. Vlade is a Hall of Fame player. And Chris will get there eventually. And then Peja and Turkoglu were just those beautiful European players who knew how to play, who knew why you play, which was to win, which was to help the flow and the glow and the show. And then they could fill it up. Peja and Turkoglu were different. Peja was one of the purest shooters you'll ever see. Very much a shot very similar to Jeff Petrie's himself. And then Turkoglu, you know, this complete unknown coming out of Turkey, of all places. And to come from Turkey and have a first name like Turk, Alu, oh my gosh, the harmonic convergences just keep flowing endlessly here. And then with Scott Pollard, a real personality in his own right, and able to come in as the sixth man in the front court and do what six men are supposed to do. When things are going well, keep it going. When things are not going well, change it up and restart the whole thing. And Scott Pollard, because of his skill level, because of his assets, his package of talent and his personality, Scott loved to mix it up. It was fantastic. And Scott Pollard and our oldest son, Adam Walton, went to high school together here in San Diego. And then Lawrence Funderburk, who was just coming into his own there. This was another guy who loved to mix it up with guys. And so the roster makeup on this Sacramento team was absolutely spectacular. And it was a destination. Arco, Sacramento, corporate jets flying in from all over the place to see these kids. And the biggest challenge for teams as they come along, as they're growing, as they're maturing, as they're working their way to the top, is to ultimately sell their own tickets. Because a lot of teams, all they can sell is the opponent. All they can sell is the attraction that's coming in that night. But the Sacramento Kings, boy, those guys, they could sell tickets because of the way they played, the speed. In 02, they had the best record in the NBA. They were the second best scoring team in the entire NBA. They had such a beautiful style, identity, and culture, the three elements that go in to making fans want to buy in and say, hey, I'm with those guys. I'm going wherever they're going. I mean, that's what the Grateful Dead had. That's what great basketball teams, that's what great companies have, that's what great bands have, that's what great anything have. Artists, performers, entertainers, they had that ability to draw the fans in, and we were just like sucked in by the biggest vacuum cleaner you've ever seen.
I want to go to game four. It was when Robert Horry hit the buzzer beater at the Staples Center. Kings had a big lead in that game. Of course, the Lakers don't go away. Champions keep fighting. But Shaq and Kobe miss shots. Vlade tips it out. Horry grabs it, hits the three-pointer at the buzzer. What do you remember about that sequence and the aftermath?
The series was seesaw all the way. The Lakers win the first game at Sacramento and take away home court advantage. Sacramento comes back and wins games 2 and 3, and they have a real chance of going up 3-1. Game four in Los Angeles. The world is watching. Sacramento has a 20-point lead in the first half. That lead shrivels a bit to 14 at the half, but Sacramento still firmly in control. Please remember that the only thing more meaningless than the partial score of an NBA game is the final score of an NBA exhibition game. And this was as serious as it gets. This is the trip to the NBA Finals. And the Lakers were going for historic record-setting territory. They were already the two-time defending champs. They were going for three. That's only been done by three different teams. Minneapolis did it in the very early days with all the Hall of Famers up, but the Lakers were still in Minnesota. The Celtics with Bill Russell, they won so many. Wow, who can even remember and count other than 11 out of 13? Unsurpassed forever. And then the Bulls, they won three in a row twice. So the Lakers, they've already won twice. And so there's a great opportunity for them to join the Lakers, Celtics, and the Bulls as one of the great historic runs in NBA history. And now game four, fate of the known world, on the line, in the balance. And what happens is that you really find out who's got a game as the series wear down. Because when you're playing the same team day after day after day, time after time, the plays, the strategy becomes irrelevant. It's who can play. And it comes back to that mantra. Players make plays. Plays don't make players. And Robert Horry, one of my favorite players of all time, remarkable sense of being in the right place at the right time. Robert Horry, growing up in the middle of nowhere in Alabama. Robert Horry getting drafted. Who would have ever thought by the Houston Rockets? Robert Horry was a center in college at Alabama, playing for Wimp Sanderson. Robert Horry gets drafted by Rudy T, who already has Akeem to play center. Robert Horry, this little skinny, wiry guy, long, yes. Tall, yes, full 6'9", 6'10". But Robert Horry turned out to be one of the most cerebral players in the history of basketball. He always knew where to be, and he was expert at teammate selection. So to go from playing with Akeem at the top of his game, one of the greatest players ever, greatest international player ever, but then to then make the move and go over and team up with Shaq, because Robert Horry could get Akeem the ball. He could get Shaq the ball. And later on, he went and got Tim Duncan and David Robinson the ball. And so that's what makes teams win. And Robert Horry happened to be at the right place at the right time. The ball came out. Vlade pushed it out, which was all he really could do. It just happened to go to somebody who was on the other team, who was in a perfect place, and who has made that shot and many other shots many, many times before. At the end of the day, to win the big ones, to win it all, to win any game, your best players have to beat their best players. And so their best players were Shaq and Kobe, the Lakers, who had their ups and downs. Kobe was sick early on. But, you know, Shaq was fantastic throughout. And now, you know, at the end of the day, game four goes down to the bitter defeat for the Sacramento Kings. And it's a situation where it's tied 2-2. Kings still have home court. But they lost something there in game four. They lost that incredible level of confidence. At confidence of, we're going to get this done. And that happens to every athlete when you give one away. Because when you have that big lead, it's very, very difficult on the road to have the huge lead early, because the games are interminable. The other team is good. That's why it's a big game. The other team's got the crowd. The crowd's never going to get tired. And the Laker crowd brought it as that game wore on. And ultimately, it was a Laker victory. And the Kings apparently recovered, won game five at home at Arco, went down, they lose game six, and then they come back for the fateful game seven. And the fateful game seven is one that we'll never forget, because I love pressure. I love it when we're at the moment of truth. I love it when we're at the moment before the moment of truth, because that's where the preparation comes in. That's when you're in that locker room and you're sitting there and you're looking at all the guys and you can feel the building shaking. You can feel it trembling. You can feel the building being worried about the crowd tearing this old building down. And so that Arco crowd that day for game seven, man, I will never forget. They were there so early. They were so fired up. They wanted blood. They wanted Phil Jackson's blood. They wanted Shaq's blood. They wanted Kobe's blood. Oh, my gosh. And then the team, it came out and just could not get the job done. It was very disappointing from the Kings' perspective. The Kings, they had their chances. In a game that went to overtime, in a game where the Kings, out of 30 free throw attempts, missed almost half, missed 14 out of 30 free throw attempts in a game that went to overtime. In a game that went to overtime, the Kings took 20 three-point shots, which by today's standards is nothing, which is, happens per quarter. But in those days, that was a lot of three-pointers. And of those 20 three-point attempts, only two of them went in. And one of the things that defines the difference between the champions and the team that doesn't get it done is that you have to be able to play your best at the very end and win a series. Particularly, you know, this was a great Laker team. You know, they had Phil Jackson, who's got the records, who's got the championships, 11 championships in 20 years of coaching. Just a spectacular resume. Some of the greatest players developed under his tutelage ever. He was also a member of two of the greatest NBA championship teams ever, back with the Knicks in the early 1970s. But with Shaq and Kobe together, I mean, two of the handful of the greatest players ever, with Robert Horry. We haven't even talked today about Rick Fox. And you got Derek Fisher. You got a bench that was okay, but nothing that's going to make you stay awake at night saying, oh my gosh, you know, we're going to be worried about Lindsey Hunter, Brian Shaw, Devin George, Mitch Richmond, and Mark Madsen. And then Samaki Walker, who made some big plays in the game four comeback for the Lakers. But this was Shaq and Kobe and three other really, really good players who were smart as could be, tough as could be, and were only concerned about winning: Derek Fisher, Robert Horry, and Rick Fox. And so for the Kings to have won that game seven, yeah, it was there. And yes, it went to overtime. But the Kings did not have the on-court leadership, did not have the peak performance on command that they needed. They did not have the one guy who was going to look at Shaq, Kobe, and Phil and say, you know what, we're taking this. Because the crowd was there, and the crowd was ready. The crowd did their job. But the missed shots, the hesitation, the reluctance, the lack of assertiveness, the lack of saying to each other, we are going to get this done, follow me, get one guy. It could have been a lot of guys, but it comes down to a collective failure of getting the job done. And so at the end of the day, in the overtime, where basically anything could happen, Shaq, Kobe, and Derek Fisher, they combined to go 8 for 8 from the free throw line. And the remarkable statistical analysis of that 7-game series, all the stats were in favor of Sacramento. Field goal percentage, +3.5. These are all numbers on the entire series. 3.5 percentage points on field goal percentage. On 3 percentage, +3, Sacramento. Free throw attempts, +19 for Sacramento. Free throw percentage, -7 for Sacramento. That is a dagger. Please, make your free throws. Offensive rebounds. What are you going to do with Shaq? How are you going to keep him off the board? Vlade gave everything he had, but Sacramento gave up 24 offensive rebounds, more than they were able to garner themselves in a 7-game series. And a lot of that can be directly attributed to the massive presence of Shaquille O'Neal. And then the passing game, the style that the Sacramento Kings utilize on a constant basis. I love passing. I love team. I love selflessness. +14 assists for Sacramento over the Lakers over the course of the 7-game series. Lakers had more blocks, 7 for the entire series. That's only 1 a game. That's not a lot. And then the incredible, remarkable statistic of all is that only 2 points separated these two teams, these two great teams, from going to the NBA Finals. Now, when the Lakers ultimately won Game 7 overtime victory, they go on and play the New Jersey Nets, and they sweep them. So that's just the way it works out. But when only 2 points separate them, it was just an absolutely spectacular and close series that we will never, ever forget. One of the things about the Sacramento Kings 2002 is that they really became the second team in NBA history that had a global presence. Today, that's just taken for granted because of what the NBA has become under David Stern and Adam Silver and all the international players that now dominate so much. But the first team that had an international presence were the Bulls. And in China, they were called the Red Ox, and they, because the translation just wasn't really working. But the Sacramento Kings, with Vlade and Peja and Turkoglu, more importantly, though, their style, because that's the international style. That's the Pete Kirill. That is Serbian. That is the European game of passing, shooting, skill, movement, fast break, and running all the time. It was just an absolutely fantastic thing to witness and to be a part of. And I'm the luckiest guy in the world that I was there, and I will never forget.
I do want to go back to Game 6 for a second, because a lot of fans feel this way, and I know some of the players did at the time. There was so much talk about the officiating in that game, and I know Sacramento people thought it went against them a little bit. Do you think that was overblown, and do you think that maybe impacted them? Maybe they got too distracted going into a Game 7.
Every team that loses always thinks it's someone else's fault. And that's what happens when you do lose. And when you're the champion, and you do lose, it's time to stand up and say, that's on me. I did not get the job done. And so when you have these incredible players who are so gifted physically and so powerful, and movement is everything, how are you going to defend Shaq? How are you going to defend Kobe? And to sit here today and complain about the referees, I don't like it. I try not to do it. But I think back to the games that I was involved in as a player where I lost. And oh my gosh, that game in Notre Dame on January 19th, 1974. Not that I remember the date. Yeah, the referees at Notre Dame. O'Shanahan, Flannery, O'Sullivan, please give me a break.
That is too crazy. That just sticks with you. You mentioned a couple things about Game 7, the way the Kings played, too. Do you think nerves impacted them in that situation? They had home court advantage. Many people thought that was going to be a big deal. But ultimately, you talked about the missed free throws, the missed threes. Those were kind of uncharacteristic for that squad. How much of that was nerves, do you think?
Nerves, pressure, anxiety, anxiousness, it all plays into it. It's what you live for. It's what you dream about as a player. It's what you want. You have to train yourself. I want to be in that position. Nobody wants to play in a game that doesn't matter. Everything mattered in this Game 7. And what happens when you have the big game? You need your coach is going to do his job. His job is to breathe life into everybody and to make them believe. And for the Sacramento Kings in Game 7, when they were so close and were unable to get it done, and the self-reflection, this brings us back to the notion of when things get tough, somebody has to step to the front and say, I'll take care of this. And that's on your best players. And where you just come out and you play so well. One of the things that you learn being the champion is that it is really, really, really hard. And you can't take anything for granted. Nothing's for certain. It can always go wrong. And you have to put everything you have, and you have to utilize every asset. And one of the great assets is that home court. That home court at Arco, that was as great as it's ever been. And when I think back to the Game 7 road victories in NBA history, I'm not sure this was the greatest by the Lakers, because I think back to two Game 7 NBA finals. 1969, Boston wins at L.A., in the Forum, Bill Russell, his last game, Sam Jones's last game, and they win on the road against Wilt and Elgin, Jerry, and all these remarkable players. And the other one was 1974, Boston at Milwaukee. Milwaukee has this incredible team of Lucius Allen and Oscar Robertson in the backcourt. Kareem in the middle, the best player I ever played against by far. Bobby Dandridge, an incredible, should be in the Hall of Fame forward player. Just absolutely spectacular. So many road victories in that 74 NBA Finals series. And Boston comes in after losing a heartbreaker on their home court, which would have won them the title in Game 6. Losing at home, and then they go to Milwaukee, and everybody's thinking, well, come on, Kareem, Oscar, Lucius, Bobby Dandridge, and, you know, Boston has no chance. Boston came out and won the game by 20 points. And so you just have to have those guys, that personality, you know, who you are, you know, what you stand for, what you're going to do, and when the moment of truth comes and that ball is in your hands, and how we're going to get this done. And when you don't get it done, you never forget. and it stays with you, because this is our lives. This is what we live for. This is what we dream about. This is what we spend every waking moment preparing for, to have that chance. The tough part is that when you're young, you just think it's just going to keep going and you're always going to be right there. The older you get, the more elusive it is. And the challenge right now for our beloved Sacramento Kings is to get back into the big time game and have Golden One become just this radiant magnet of excellence. And the free agents and the draft picks and the trades are all coming in, and the place is packed, and the jets are flying in from all around the world to watch the Sacramento Kings going for their first championship in Sacramento, in the Golden State, at Golden One.
I hope that happens, Bill. I want to go back to something you said earlier, too. You talked about the Jay Will trade. They ended up getting Mike Bibby, and Bibby really emerged in that 2002 playoffs and, of course, in that Kings-Lakers series. What did he provide for that team? What did he do that kind of put them over the top in the West?
One of the hardest skills in basketball is to be a great one-on-one player, to be able to create your own shot. It sounds simple as can be. Everybody tries it, but only a few guys can really do it. Kareem could do it. Larry Bird could do it. Michael Jordan could do it. Shaq could get his own shot. Kobe ultimately could get his own shot. LeBron can get his own shot. But what Mike Bibby was able to bring to this team of guys who were more complementary type of players. I mean, Doug Christie, he wasn't going to get his own shot. Bobby Jackson, he could get his own shot on the days that he was on fire. But Bobby wasn't the type of player who did it every single game. He came with his best effort every game, but he didn't always deliver. He didn't always have it. Gerald Wallace was just getting started. Chris Webber, another guy who could get his own shot. Vlade, against Shaq, is not going to be able to get the type of shots that he normally would be able to get against other players. Shaq is just that good. Peja and Turgaloo were more off-the-ball type players. And so with Mike Bibby coming in, and Jason Williams, as good as he was not a scorer. He was a guy who could create for the team to score. But he was not somebody who could just say, okay, give me the ball and get out of the way, and I'm going to either make a basket or I'm going to get to the free throw line. And Mike Bibby could do that. And that just elevated the Sacramento Kings to a whole nother level. Because over the course of the interminable NBA season, I mean, there's so much basketball and so many different things, and injuries and problems and off nights and fatigue and all the different stuff. If you have that guy who can just take the ball and go, and that guy is as durable and as tough and as creative and imaginative and still selfless as Mike Bibby, you've got a real chance to win it all. Injuries play a huge role in the outcome of history. No one knows that better than I do, having missed more than 9.5 full seasons of my 14-year NBA career. But it was heartbreaking. In 2002, the Sacramento Kings, over the course of the year, were the best team in the NBA. But to have Peja Stojakovic go down with that ankle injury in the second round and miss significant portions of the second round, and then to miss the first four complete games of the Western Conference Finals, and really only played in three games, and in those three games, was not able to be the Peja Stojakovic that I think belongs in the Basketball Hall of Fame, as just this magnificently beautiful, sculpted player who had such rhythm, who had such grace, who had such dignity, who had such class. And he was coming and he was playing in this beautiful existence. And it's all going well. And the Kings are on fire, and they're rolling, and they're about to be crowned. And then the simple twist of fate of an ankle turning over, and the wheel goes flat, and nobody can find a pump. Oh, my. How sad, the breaks of the game. You never know. If only. If only.
So true. I think a lot of people miss that. Peja not playing and then coming back, missing that big shot in game seven. That he was banged up. I want to ask you, get your thoughts on Rick Adelman. I think he's one of the most underappreciated head coaches in our game. What made Rick such a good coach?
Rick Adelman was a classic example of what it takes to be an excellent NBA coach. He came up through the ranks. He was a part of expansion teams, San Diego, Portland. He was part of better teams later on. But mostly what he did was that he learned. He was a tough, hard-nosed competitor as a player, but he watched, he witnessed, he was exposed to lots of great leadership opportunities, styles, and different ways, different path forward to the promised land. And so Rick Adelman, when he got this team, he was perfect because the team had personality. What they didn't have was the structure and the level of consistency that it takes to be great. And he brought that. He brought that level of, guys, this is every day. How we do anything is how we do everything. We have a chance. We have a chance to make this really, really special. And when you're part of something special, your life is never the same again. And when you talk to any of these guys, and how much, and we talked to Mike Bibby, and Doug Christie, Bobby Jackson, all still involved. Chris Webber comes to all the games. Vlade, the president, the GM, and Peja right there with him. You talk to all these guys, and the dreams, the memories, the friendships, the bonds, it is so special. And that never happens without a great coach. There has never been a great player, a great team, a great company, a great organization that didn't have a great coach. Sacramento, we, the NBA, the world, basketball, incredibly fortunate that Rick Adelman was in the right place at the right time.
You were one of the best passing big men in NBA history. And at the time the Kings were clicking, Vlade and Weber were such gifted passers. What did that do for the offense to have not one, but two bigs who could pass the way those two did?
What Vlade and Chris Weber did, their ability to play interchangeable double post, high, low, weak side, strong side, didn't matter. They were basketball players. Players make plays. Plays don't make players. And Vlade and Chris, they could do anything and everything with the ball. And they loved the show. They loved the game. They loved the spirit. And there's nothing better than when you're passing that ball around and the defense is just spinning around and they have no idea whatsoever where the ball is going. And both Chris and Vlade with the behind-the-back passes, with the fake passes, with the incredible imagination and creativity, I just would have loved the opportunity to just dive, to be injected right into their bloodstream and to be and end up inside their brains and see what they were thinking and where they saw all these opportunities that nobody else could possibly see. And most importantly, they were willing passers. They loved it. And the way that would inspire the crowd, because the crowd knows it's all about the team. It's all about everybody being involved, and the values and the human characteristics and personal attributes that the players show and being part of a team. That's what the crowd lives in their own lives, and that's what they want to be a part of. And so when the rebound would come, whether it be Vlade or Chris or Christie or Pollard or any of these guys who get the rebound, because it was a team that was based on skill. They weren't a bunch of specialists. Yes, there were some aspects of their games that were better than others, but everybody could do everything. Everybody could shoot. Everybody could pass, dribble, think, catch. And and everybody wanted to win. Everybody had the ultimate goal, that collective sense of effort and purpose of why we're doing this, and that's to win the game. And so they did that beautifully, and the crowd just responded. And it was epic to be in Arco and to see the plays unfold from a defensive stop, a block, a rebound, a deflection, a steal, quickly into transition, up the court, cross the court, throw a lob, who knows, Weber throwing it down, Christie hitting threes, Bobby Jackson driving the lane, Peja and Turkoglu making spectacular step back threes, Lawrence Funderburk coming alive there, Scott Pollard mixing it up inside, Mike Bibby taking control, and then Mike would go over and sit down and clip his fingernails during the timeouts. I couldn't believe it all, and I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I was there.
I want to ask you about Shaq, because you know bigs better than anyone. What were the challenges of defending a player like Shaq, especially in the middle of his prime like that?
Shaq was one of the greatest players ever, who happened to be really, 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 really big. And that just created so many problems for anybody else. He changed the game. And there has not been a center that have impact like that since Shaq. That's how dominant and how impactful and important he was in the history of basketball. And then Vlade had the unenviable task of guarding Shaq. But that's the way it goes. And you have to figure out some way. I mean, I was super lucky in that I had brilliant coaches. Six of my coaches are in the Basketball Hall of Fame. And my favorite player ever of all time was Bill Russell. And Bill Russell, he had to go up against Wilt. And they played 142 times. And Wilt had his best games ever against Bill Russell. Yet Bill Russell's teams were able to win. And so the challenge for Vlade, the challenge for anybody, and during this time, nobody could respond. Nobody could create that challenge. And what you ultimately have to do when you're playing against someone who is so overwhelmingly superior in terms of size and strength and power and everything, is that you have to take that game away from him. And the best that I ever saw at that was Dave Cowens. Dave Cowens was at most 6'9", barely 6'9". But Dave Cowens, he could play ball. And this was at an era, Dave Cowens, in early 1970s, when every center in the NBA was a Hall of Famer, and most of them were ultimately members of the NBA's all-time team. And that era was led by Wilt and Kareem. And Dave Cowens was the only player I ever saw who could take it directly to Wilt and Kareem. And his ability to get out in transition, to initiate offense with dribble handoffs, to get to the offensive glass, to space the floor, to set screens, to run and run and run to keep his opponent, Wilt or Kareem, out of the action and behind the play. That was critical to the Celtics' success, as they won two championships in a glorious era of basketball. Should have been three, but for the same injury or injury plague and problem that Peja Stojakovic suffered with his sprained ankle, John Havlicek in 1973, when they were cruising to yet another championship. John Havlicek, as great a player who's ever played, he separates his shoulder. He had to play one arm, and he just couldn't do that. And the Knicks were able to come back and win their second championship. So the challenge for Shaq, nobody was ever able to do it. But there was Vlade was close, but he wasn't able to take – Vlade was not able to take the game away from Shaq. And one of the elements of being the leader, one of the elements of being the guy, is that you have to make them play your game. You define the terms of the conflict. Grateful Dead wrote a song. I'm going to tell you how it's going to be. And that is what I never saw really anybody able to do against Shaquille O'Neal. That's how good, that's how big, that's how strong, that's how tough he was.
Do you think that that Kings team is one of the best teams ever not to win a championship?
There are a lot of teams that were really, really good that did not win a championship. This Sacramento team, whoa, what a squad. So close. Because when you look back and you think of all the things they had going for them in their favor, to where you think to yourself, you know, they can win. They could win. They should win. And then they don't. But that is really the story of life, of history. And that is why when you struggle, when you fail, when the ball goes the other way, when you don't get the job done, ultimately your test in life is to take the worst things that ever happened to you and ultimately make them into the best. Now, sadly, the Kings were not able to recover from that. And the injury next year in the playoffs for Chris Webber when he hurt his knee. Chris ultimately got traded 2.5 years after the 0-2 magnificent run. And the Kings, you know, are still trying to get back into that spot. But the elements are still there. The fans are still there. Vivek is fantastic. Vlade, the brilliant genius, running the show in the front office. And now the players. The players have to come together. The players have to learn, listen from the coach, and they have to go out on the court and get the job done. Because talk is cheap and vision true. Let's go. We've seen it once. Once we've seen it, we know it can happen. Now we've got to make it happen.
What is one word you'd use to describe that 2002 Kings season? You know, obviously it was great, but it ultimately led to a disappointment. What's the one word you'd use to describe that season in 2002?
As you get older, your perspective changes, your sense of relativity changes, and your sense of what determines success. How do you measure that? And I played for a remarkable coach in college. His name was John Wooden. And he never talked about winning and losing, although we won at a record pace. Never mentioned winning or losing. He always talked about the effort to win. He always talked about doing your best. And then he would always look at us, and everything he said made no sense whatsoever when we were teenagers and playing for him. This was 50 years ago. Over the course of the next 50 years, everything he said came true. And the last and the final thing that he ever told us, time and time again, was success is the peace of mind that comes with the self-satisfaction of knowing that you did your best. I thought that was all nonsense. It wasn't until recently in my life that became crystal clear to me. I'm 67 years old right now. Coach Wooden was right. I'm the slowest learner that he's ever had. If these players can look back and say to themselves, we did our best. I have peace of mind. I have the self-satisfaction that we did our best. Generally, in my life, when I've failed and when I haven't got the job done, I look back and I say, you know, there's things I could have done better. And if I had been better, the outcome would have been different. And so I try to change my behavior. I try to work on my consistency, my proficiency, my efficiency. I try to work on every aspect of who I am and what I stand for and what I'm trying to do. And at the end of the day, now that I'm no longer physically competing, this body is broken, but I'm alive and I'm moving and I'm going for it still in other aspects. And it's much easier today to be able to say, I did my best. And I do have the peace of mind that comes from the self-satisfaction of knowing that's what I did. my best.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.